CliffCentral.com. Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to another episode of Unbranded. I'm Timothy Maurice, and this is your podcast where we explore the link between human and brand behavior. I'm extremely excited about today's podcast because, you know, out of all of my body of work, particularly, you know, starting from my first book called Thinking About You to this latest book produced in 2016, Personal Brand Intelligence, my book published in 2010, Personavation, has been the bestseller by far. It has gone to the 8th reprint now. And people ask me all the time, why do you think that book was so successful? And why is it still in such high demand? I believe the answer is quite simple. Personavation is about reinventing your personal brand. And we live in a time and an age where we are constantly reinventing ourselves. You can follow me on Twitter at Timothy Maurice, on Instagram at InstaTimothy. InstaTimothy. You know, I'm enjoying social media because I get a chance to engage everyone and get your feedback and share your ideas. So please, thank everyone who's been following the show on Cliff Central. I really appreciate your feedback and your thoughts and everyone who's giving me suggestions. I'm still getting a lot of feedback. I received a tweet this morning from someone who really loved our books episode. So this is actually a follow-up to our books episode where I'm going to give you sort of the front and back and the core around this book, Personavation. I want to thank Rianette Lebowitz, our current format, where she gives us a cyber health feature at the end of the show, is coming to an end. We move into sort of a podcast-only format, and Rianette is going to be exploring other ventures. So today, after I finish with the Personavation, how to reinvent your personal brand topic, Rianette is going to be giving her final episode, and I'm so grateful for her contribution and what she's been able to do. And make sure you check her out and continue to follow her, and that's Safe, S-A-V-E-T-N-E-T, on Facebook. Thank you so much, Rianette. I really, really appreciate it. So to today's episode, Personavation. I coined this word, Personavation, around 2007. Wow, it's been about 10 years now. In 2007, I coined the phrase Personavation, which is basically personal innovation. And novation, which is sort of the core root of this word, come from the Roman novate, which means to let go of something to gain something new. And from Brand America to the tech world, the world is moving fast and reinventing itself like never before. So I feel like this content is extremely relevant, and I'm going to give you the first few chapters of this book and the conclusion. You can get this book on ebook on Amazon. We'll post the link, and I look forward to your feedback after the show. The book is broken down into, I give Personal Brand Philosophy 101, Personal Brand Philosophy 201, Personal Brand Philosophy 301. Then I go into this idea of position for newness. Then I give you the introduction. Then I give you the case for personal brand reinvention. Now, the core body of the book is broken down into 7 P's to reinventing your personal brand. I'm not going to give you those, but I'm going to give you the conclusion called Live Your Unlived Brand. So I'm going to break it down from the very beginning all the way up to the case for reinventing your brand. And then I'm going to give you how to go about or the idea of overcoming resistance. Okay, so that's going to be the thrust of today's episode. Again, I'm Timothy Maurice, and I am thrilled to be giving you another episode of Unbranded. I start off the book with a couple of quotes. One by David Byrne. He says, I'd like to be known for more than being the guy in the big suit. And I believe all of us have this sort of goals where we want to be more. We want to be known for more. Think about it quickly. What are you known for? Is it aligned with your core sort of values? Is it aligned with who you are? Have you outgrown what you are known for? Are you trapped in a label? The essence of this book challenges that society wants to put labels on you, and often we get stuck underneath those labels, and those labels cause us much misery and pain. It's your job to constantly peel off those labels and position yourself with new labels that align with who you are. The only reason why we need labels, and I'll explore this in a moment, is because people need to be able to identify you with something. When you see stripes on a tiger, that lets you know it's a tiger and it's not a dog, and it helps protect us. The wonderful Indian actress Sundara says, "I'd like to be known for my character." What would you like to be known for? Personal Brand Philosophy 101. The story you are known for is what I term your personal brand. If what you're known for, both when you look in the mirror and when you see others, were aligned more closely to your actual value, you would experience less social friction and more personal resistance. Personal Philosophy 201. When your stakeholders, family members, boss, business partners, neighbors, and future husband or wife see you as less than your potential, they project less onto you. This is the origin of interpersonal and interpersonal conflict and the birthplace of being devalued, overlooked, taken for granted, and underappreciated. Personal Brand Philosophy 301. It is inevitable that you will outgrow your reputation or the labels assigned to you. Redefining and creating new labels for your brand is termed personal brand innovation or personization. So that's how we got to where we are. The progress from 101 to 301 is a movement towards reinvention and ownership of the idea to reinvent yourself. So I open up the book with the chapter called Position for Newness. Like a butterfly, Melissa's metamorphosis seemed to occur overnight. Despite her New York accent, her perfect olive skin and jet black hair were clearly of Latino origin. On that freezing October morning, her Ecuadorian youthful innocence was her most distinguishable trait. But a close second was her disdain for working in retail at Macy's. My mission was to recruit and mold new employees for the largest men's retailer in America. So when I saw her focused on perfecting her department, I knew in the right environment a transformation could take place, revealing a striking young woman, as professional as she was beautiful. Now in my fifth year of recruiting, I had a knack for spotting young talent, those who had what I considered to be the retail formula. Barely a year after the September 11th terrorist attacks, the clothing business was tough. Consumer confidence was down, and scouting for new employees was difficult. However, I was focused and determined to surround myself with the best people. In the back of my mind, I knew I was going to launch my own business in the next couple of years, so there wasn't time to waste. My modus operandi was to uncover rough diamonds, facilitate their polishing, watch their value appreciate, and then unleash them back into the market. In addition, if I were to make an impact in the market and position myself for the next chapter of my life, I would need to work long hours, and this required finding people who I would much enjoy working with. Melissa was literally the formula personified. She was university age, great smile, striking features, self-assured, self-disciplined, and a virgin to good corporate leadership. Of course, to confirm my gut feeling, I would need to make my move. After observing her from a distance for 15 minutes, I swooped in, introduced myself, and told her that I represented the men's retailer, Men's Warehouse. She said she knew about the master retailer and asked why I had approached her. With blunt certainty, I told her that I wanted her to work with my team, and she was willing to go out of my way to ensure it happened. She smiled and attempted to speak. Before she could do so, I asked if she was happy. She replied no. I prodded further, got the answers I needed, and then made her an offer. The rest is history. 3 months into our working relationship, 95% of my assumptions had been affirmed. Despite harboring the occasional laziness most students are guilty of, Melissa was highly disciplined and eager to enter the next chapter of her life. She was now in a critical cocoon phase of her life. A year or so from graduation, she was positioned perfectly to shed the label curious student and replace it with influential professional. Individuals with values such as discipline, integrity, structure, etc., become very frustrated when they are constantly undermined, taken for granted, and overlooked. It was obvious that helping Melissa to usher in a new dimension of her persona was a win-win for us both. I spent more time with Melissa than I had ever spent with anyone. Occasionally, I even invited her out to social events. We became so close, she would phone me regularly to ask for strategic advice about boyfriends. The backdrop that formed Melissa's cocoon was a focused leadership environment and men's clothing retail division comprised of about 25 employees. As we set goals and met our targets, as she learned the art and science of sales, as she became engrossed in talk of self-love, all the while becoming more focused about the application of her skill sets in a post 9/11 workplace, her metamorphosis began to happen in front of my eyes. Much of Melissa's reinvention would have occurred irrespective of our meeting. And perhaps this is the main point of this book. That irrespective of your conscious involvement and ownership in your personal transformation, everyone goes through rebirthing at different stages. You can either participate in the process and make specific concerted choices, or ignore the stimuli you're presented with and remain in your cocoon. The Swedish diplomat author Dag Hammarskjöld said, "At every moment you choose yourself." But do you choose yourself? Body and soul contain 1,000 possibilities out of which you can build many eyes. But in one of them, there is a congruence of the elector and the elected. Only one, which is your eye. He was being provocative because many people take for granted that the eye should seamlessly transition inside and between one of every individual's three phases of personal brand metamorphosis. Phase one, guaranteed phase, which is puberty to adulthood, to midlife crisis to senior citizen. Those are guaranteed phases. There's two, learned. Marriage to divorce, obese to skinny, rags to riches, and of course the many aspects of work life such as manager to CEO. Then you have what I call the third phase, which is conscious, feeling helpless to in control, short-sighted to visionary, uncaring to empathetic, injury to healing, and so on. Take for example the metaphor of a butterfly. Emerging from its cocoon, the caterpillar remains inextricably linked to its identity. But because the emerging butterfly's wings are so striking, the creepy, crawly feeling you got when observing the caterpillar is now replaced with the sheer awe at the butterfly's majesty. 14 months after moving to South Africa, I returned to visit Melissa in New York and was really struck by her new wings. She admitted the value of her cocoon experience, during which she discovered her purpose, built a solid value system, and realized the power of image and the need to position her brand. Melissa had discovered personavation, and since graduation is now working as a successful professional, taking New York by storm. Second chapter, introduction, the birth of personavation. Today the factory was colder and louder than usual. My mandatory earplugs felt useless against the constant crack and thunder that bellowed from the machine assigned to me for my new job of making cardboard boxes. While the hundreds of other workers didn't seem to be the happiest group in the world, the hammering, the 12-hour shift, the wages of barely above minimum, the slave-driving supervisor who barked at the slightest sign of a slower pace, the offer, lumberjack uniforms, and all the other life-numbing conditions seemed to be an accepted norm. At 18 years old, it all seemed unfair. America was supposed to be a country designed for living your dream. But the only dream I was living was the one in my head. Snuggled deeper than the hammering was a voice reminding me that my father's dream of me becoming a manufacturing operator was his dream, not mine. My father's a towering man. He was at least 4 inches taller than me. And somewhere in the height differential was a gap that deserved respect. He always seemed taller than the people he managed. Those who looked up to him did so both figuratively and literally. As a kid, I watched him overcome alcoholism, and at the insistence of my praying mother, join our community church. Watching the transition was like watching a homeless bum turn himself into Superman. From a stumbling regular Joe to a superhero who taught class in church, to singing in two choirs, one of which he managed, to coaching my sister's softball team and being an assistant coach of my baseball team. So when this man told me that I should forego college, I ignored all the evidence to the contrary. Evidence such as graduating in the top 10 of my class with having a horde of teachers who predicted amazing things about my potential. A super dad with 4 more inches of know-how had labeled me a manufacturer, and there I found myself, 4 inches below my potential, making cardboard boxes when I should have been at university exploring my dreams. After 10 days of box making, I became fed up with my father's label of manufacturer and even tired of the son sub-label of box maker. Late in the afternoon on that 10th day, I became totally consumed with my dreams. So I made a box and crawled inside. There, I daydreamed about becoming a designer, author, and thought leader, and eventually fell asleep in the box. After being discovered by my slave master, I was immediately fired. I grew bold in the heat of the moment. I shouted, "You can't fire me. I quit. I have dreams to pursue." This letting go gave me the opportunity to confront the label my father had slapped on me. Confronting those 4 inches wasn't easy. I knew I would be labeled a loser and told that I would never amount to anything. But the fire inside was burning much larger than those 4 inches. So after dinner the following Sunday, I summoned the courage to look him in the eye and tell him that the factory had let me go and I would now enroll in college. And even if I had to pay for it myself, and furthermore, I would never be a manufacturer again. After wrangling through my confession, his stare reciprocated the exact contempt I had imagined, but there was one difference. On this day, he seemed 8 inches taller. I stormed out of the room, out of fear more than anything, and began packing, determined to move out of his house. I wanted to do it before I was forced out, but it was too late. He kicked me out. So I moved out of my hometown to a nearby city with big universities into a friend's apartment where there were already 3 roommates too many, and found myself sleeping on a torn and dusty couch. It was on this couch that I almost turned back to the manufacturer label, but I was determined to stand taller than the 4 inches and that cold stack of boxes. In life, you will come to a crossroad or you will face the daunting choice of either becoming resigned to the idea of how others see you or removing the sticky labels given to you by your family, friends, neighbors, and teachers. This book is a book about a process of creating new labels that will explore the vast potential beating in your heart of hearts and about you putting on a more deserving label, one that aligns with your values, your purpose, and ultimately your dreams. My hope is that this work will inspire and equip you at your crossroad experience where you either shed or affirm the labels assigned to you. Next chapter, the case for personal brand reinvention. At some point in each of our histories, we must ask ourselves if we are the labels assigned to us. And if we're not, then we must work to peel off our labels and apply new ones that do reflect who we are and who we aspire to be. We must embark on a journey to redefine our brands, to redefine and rebrand ourselves. Many argue that labeling others is unhealthy, but as you will come to know in this book, the brain desires labels to maneuver through life in a highly efficient manner. The need for personal brand reinvention isn't confined to individuals, gender, race, short people, countries, corporations, the elderly, or the religious community. Anyone or any group feeling pigeonholed by label would benefit from this process of repositioning. South Africa would do well to be more aggressive at peeling off its old label of a struggle country. Zulus would benefit from shedding the warrior label. America would find a way to peel back the self-centered, arrogant label that lingers on its reputation. According to Sartre, a Jew, and arguably the best-known philosopher of the 20th century, he says, they, the Jews, have allowed themselves to be positioned by the stereotypes that others have of them. And they live in fear that their acts will correspond to their stereotype. We may say that their conduct is perpetually overdetermined from the inside. An example of this is the African-American hip-hop community. Fine young men are consumed by the notion that they are aggressive and dangerous and therefore have purchased the stereotype and now leverage it in their music as well as throughout the culture. A quick Google into the backgrounds of hip-hop ambassadors will show you that most of them were born far from sizzling steak, closer to a cupcake. The Jewish, as well as the hip-hop community, will benefit from selling the world new ideas born out of their current value system. Perhaps the resentment both feel would soften by sharing new stories and new ideas about their cultures on a widespread scale in movies, books, through various media outlets. As you will see, redefining brands is for everyone. The principle and ideas of this philosophy are relevant for people, products, place, or anything with an associated story or brand. The influence surrounding every brand story is a result of someone measuring his or her value against the brand's perceived values. Consequently, if your stakeholders perceive your values incorrectly or are simply not attracted to them, then the expected reaction can only be for devaluation to occur or worse, ill treatment. If you value tall, dark, and handsome, my story will walk right past you in the mall. The main ingredient that drives the need for this book is this simple fact. We determine our value by measuring our value against others who value themselves against us. Ultimately, it's against the backdrop of others' values that we determine the price we place on ourselves. While I realize this statement could appear rather presumptuous and perhaps a bit difficult to swallow, this book will interrogate and hopefully prove its worth. In For Whom the Bell Tolls, 1940, Ernest Hemingway wrote a line that has always stuck with me. He says, "Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. The more conscious I am of a place in society, the more I understand that everyone, from the wealthiest to the poorest, and including every religion and all beliefs, provides a matrix in which our values flourish and thrive. When a person is no longer, the matrix shifts, and it is at this point that I question and interrogate my values. Without each other, the need to check ourselves ceases to exist. I've actually developed a perception formula for how the majority of us measure ourselves. It goes like this. Self-perception plus perceived perception plus market perception equals desired perception. To ignore either side of the equation is reckless. To desire more for oneself without considering others is un-African. To consider only ourselves, or to consider only others without delving into the magnificence that lies within you, is also not responsible. As you consider the matrix you use to measure yourself brand success, it's important to recognize that the perception of material goods, health, spirituality, education, etc., are all determined by the exposure you have and the company you keep. Enough exposure to the green movement would surely inspire you to consider how your consumption patterns impact the planet. A friend of mine proudly drove a big black Hummer II until he realized this was now a turnoff for young women who appreciated vehicles with less environmental impact. If being overweight is praised in your community, you'll probably think skinny looks ridiculous. If furthering your education by going to university has always been presented to you as a waste of time, you'll more than likely find a way to skip it. This is why neighborhoods have community policing agencies called body corporates, who place strict rules on lawn care and general upkeep of your home. The cold reality is that your neighbors value and well-being impacts on the value and your well-being. Therefore, we must change the question to ask, is the success and direction of my personal brand misguided by the valuation of my neighbors? And moreover, have we incorrectly over or undervalued ourselves based on those who are closest to us? Too many people have emotionally impotent, small thinking, and shallow people occupying their perception formula. A successful personal brand formula requires inserting people who have value or value themselves by striving for excellence. The type of people who aren't afraid to applaud your success and cheer you on as you strive for victory. Victorious leaders who have managed to live the movement and control their formula are numerous. But I share stories of familiar subjects such as South Africa's first democratically elected president, Nelson Mandela. For this ability to let go of the label struggle fighter, put down his gun, and forgive his previous oppressor, he became arguably the world's most respected statesman. In fact, it may seem a bit cliche, but I regard this greatness to lie in his ability to know when to redefine himself for the next chapter of his life. You would think that in the winter of his remarkable life, he would have been happy with the label he was known for. Yet, on his 89th birthday, the man who many personal brand experts agree was the most powerful individual brand in history literally asked for a reputation makeover. Nelson Mandela's foundation chief executive, Akma Danger, said that at Mandela's insistence, the organization would be working hard to break down the mythology around the man. My father had created a myth in my mind that I was destined to be a manufacturer, and if I had not found the courage to relabel myself, I would have been my father's brand. Mandela believed it was important to protect his true brand legacy, and therefore believed a campaign must be constructed to control the media's predisposition to manipulate high-profile individuals for their gain. Mandela said that he wanted his label to be known for the promotion of reconciliation, non-racial dialogue, debate, and empowering youth, not for a larger-than-life figure who shares great photos with international billionaires. All of us at some point in our lives will be known for something that doesn't align with our deepest values. Unfortunately, most of us will not enjoy the luxury of a multi-million rand foundation to realign our reputation. Personification is a journey of personal reinvention. As you'll discover, the second part of the worst of the word comes from the term innovation. Most people associate innovation with technology. However, innovation is birthed from its root novate, which means to replace with something new, especially an old obligation with a new one. In much the same way as iconic brands such as Apple refuse complacency by aggressively innovating, even redesigning their phones almost monthly, you must create new dimensions in your personal brand to ensure your goals and dreams are achieved. In the course of the last few years, I've been exceptionally preoccupied with inspiring leaders to replace their old reputations with ones that they deserve. Personal branding is about redefining and positioning your story or reputation, or personal innovation is about creating a new story or an improved story out of the old one. The principles explored are centuries old and almost without exception are universally applicable to the nearly 7 billion people around the world. You may be thinking that you have little in common with Nelson Mandela. Some of you may be even thinking that you don't even have a brand. But whether you are a global icon, a CEO with shareholders, a singer with fans to satisfy, or a mother with children to convince of your authority, all of us have a number of stakeholders who hold our reputation in their minds. A Venezuelan author, Claus Jaffe, writes in his work, Evolution of Shame, reputation is so important that some societies have started what sociologists call social punishment. This type of punishment works because individuals know that someone has broken rules and they voluntarily cooperate with enforcing the accuser's punishment. Of course, part of the reason why, for this cooperation is the risk of similar punishment for non-cooperation. But a major part is that if an individual could harm someone else, he or she could harm you too. Social punishment works because when a person is seen to have broken the rules, he or she is labeled as having a bad character. Soon everyone knows A as a person with a bad or weak character, and society is now empowered to treat them accordingly, usually by avoiding contact. Once A gets a bad reputation, and this is how I perceive the term, not as some centrally imposed certificate, in traditional society, it is very difficult for A to regain a good one. People individually decide whether a bad character is indeed bad, and depending on the stature of the individual and the bad character, may or may not cooperate with any punishment. Someone with an impeccable reputation, such as a priest in a traditional society, is permitted to interact with even the worst of characters. One problem with such a reputation system is that it can be too effective, and once the label has been assigned, it often can't be undone or peeled off. Once ostracized, the system makes it very difficult for someone to rejoin society. To have his or her reformation recognized, the channel in traditional societies include lots of good work and recommendation by good citizens, such as the priest. The other is a new identity. A powerful illustration of a reputation system can be found in Victor Hugo's Les Miserables, 1862, which is ex-convict Jean Valjean is ostracized by society despite having been released from prison. A priest's kindness is not enough, and he later gains a very good reputation building an industry. The notable thing is that he rejoins society only when he gets a new identity, and later goes back to prison when his old identity is discovered, which is a clear illustration of how reputation can affect punishment. Herein lies the genius of Nelson Mandela. Before, during, and after South Africa's struggle for freedom, he recognized at critical junctures the need to innovate and manage perception. When he refused to be released from prison because it would be seen as a crippling compromise, when he stepped down from his presidency after 4 honorable years, and lastly, when he recognized the need to break down the myth hovering over his brand so that generations to come will benefit from his legacy. The birth of a brand. My first print column in South Africa was small. The shortest article my editor had ever accepted was 225 words. The Star Workplace was the ideal space for my ideas. Its readership wanted contextualized ideas for their workplace challenges, and they wanted them in small doses. Although I didn't get paid for my small contributions, I tried to make sure that each idea, every opinion, and all research were entered into with all my might. In the space of 24 months, the column grew from once a quarter to once a month to bi-monthly. Before I knew it, my reputation grew. I began to get work based on the issues and attitudes associated with my writing. But more importantly, after 3.5 years, the column was so widely read that a relationship with my readership had developed, allowing me the insight into Southern African psyche. The readers became comfortable and open and provoked me to go even deeper. My writing grew with my readers, the testimonies poured in, and I was able to put my finger on the pulse of the region. Moreover, I gained a firm grasp on what it would take to place my finger on the pulse of the people. Here's some feedback from one reader after I wrote a column about Jacob Zuma to the middle of his tumultuous campaign to lead South Africa. Mr. Webster, Wes Webster, greetings. Your article yesterday used a man I've always respected from back in the days when I was running for ANC's intelligence apparatus during the war against the National Party regime, and as an example of how one has to brand himself. You took me back to the 1st of September 2003 when I was doing my medical studies in Cuba, and he had arrived at the airport in Havana, and his arrival was broadcast live on TV Cubana. It was 11:20, and all flights landing and taking off were suspended. He was received by the then president of Cuba, Dr. Fidel Castro, From that day, my respect for Mshalozi grew. I hope that many of people would learn a lot from him. I'm not saying that he's innocent, but I can't wait for him to be the state president of our republic. I'm a socialist at heart, and I appreciate capitalism. Keep up the good work. Hopefully I'll visit your offices one day. I'm just 30 minutes away from them. I stay in Rudaport. Dr. Rodney Peto. Now, what's fascinating about this letter, before I go on, is that I would have never been able to have reach and grow my brand in a way that demonstrated my deepest values if I didn't connect with the reader. So at the crux of my brand development has been able to have an exchange with the reader. I continue. Whatsoever your hands findeth to do, do it with all your might. This biblical passage should be on everyone's personal manifesto. Another translation reads, whatever your hands findeth to do, do it with all your power. Irrespective of your faith or religious background or lack thereof, the message is poignant. From the lowest menial tasks, such as writing a small column next to the classified section, one that many people tease me about, calling it insignificant, to the job of your dreams, do it with passion, fervor, and a caring spirit. Many up-and-coming brands are mired in an attitude of entitlement that suggests, unless I get a certain pay, or unless I'm promoted into a certain position, or if my boss speaks to me a certain way, I refuse to dedicate myself and give 100%. This attitude is limiting. While I'm not a Buddhist monk or a pastor, I profess to strive towards being an ambassador for life's basic principles. Once I sign a contract to consult a local men's clothing retailer and partner in various aspects of the business's growth. During the first week, I found myself folding cashmere sweaters. As an author who has written and contributed to several books, I would have been forgiven for delegating smaller tasks. Instead, I rolled up my sleeves, pulled out the folding board, and ensured that each fold and crease carried my personal stamp of approval. When each day ends and you find yourself staring in the mirror at your personal brand, it's not your boss, nor is it the government you must answer to. It's yourself. It's your fingerprint that remains. No task is too small for your devotion. This brings me to a point of the 7 P's of personal branding, which I'm not going to go into. It would take several hours. But I am going to go to the conclusion, which will take a few more moments, and then we'll have RiaNet's Cyber Health feature coming up. The conclusion, and the reason why I decided to share this, and hopefully you're going to be inspired now to go and download the book off of Amazon and get the ebook on your tablet or your phone. The reason why I decided to share the conclusion, I think it's going to give you the exact sort of theory and understanding of why reinventing yourself is so critical and why the 7 steps is going to be important for you to read further. Conclusion, live your unlived brand. Live the beauty in your unlived brand. Most of us have 2 lives, the life we live and the unlived life within us. Between the two stand resistance. This final chapter is dedicated to those of you who want to join the personification movement and overcome resistance to relabel and explore the possibilities of the unlived. Many of you have friends who live amazing lives, spending holidays frolicking in exotic destinations, while you sit at your desk and ask yourself the same old questions, what am I doing wrong? All of us at some point in our lives will experience a bit of resistance. Ever quit a diet before getting started? Are you a writer who doesn't write? A singer who doesn't sing? An entrepreneur who never starts a venture? Then you know what resistance is. The arch enemy of personal brand innovation is resistance. It's the most toxic force on the planet. It is the root of more unhappiness than poverty, disease, and power outages. Resistance is faster than a speeding bullet and more powerful than a locomotive. If you feel as though resistance is plaguing your life, you are not alone. There are more unwritten books, untraveled holidays, unproduced songs, and unexplored business ventures in the grave than on this blessed earth. The key is not to let go of your dreams and remain optimistic and to continue seeing beauty in the belly of resistance. In Viktor Frankl's 1946 book, Man's Search for Meaning, Frankl, a prisoner in one of history's most brutal concentration camps, believed there could be meaning in the worst conditions. In a moment of stunning bravery, while experiencing extreme torture at the brutal Auschwitz camp, Franco provides an inroad to the true power of beauty while overcoming resistance from the worst sources. Occasionally, he says, I looked at the sky where the stars were fading and the pink light of the morning was beginning to spread behind dark blank of clouds. But my mind clung to my wife's image, imagining it with an uncanny acuteness. I heard her answering me, saw her smile, her frank and encouraging look. Real or not, her look was then more luminous than the sun which was beginning to rise. We all endure pain and experience resistance differently. So why is it that beauty eludes many and others like Frankl are able to construct a filter which seems to manufacture beauty in the most raw of circumstances? The great Chinese thinker Confucius said, everything has beauty, but not everyone sees it. Herein lies our greatest clue. Beauty is a choice. When life presents stimuli which goes contrary to your wishes and creates painful scars, we can choose to see the scarring as an artistic brushstroke rather than a debilitating wound. Since all of us see and experience life differently, perhaps there is no single definition of beauty. I'm learning that beauty is fluid rather than a concrete entity. Our personal brands are like a canvas, and as the world throws paint our way, it's our choice to mix it and use our brush to paint master strokes. As you paint, paint with patience, certainty, knowing you are the most important person who will review the painting. From the ages 25 to 28, I saw little beauty and wanted, From the age of 25 to 28, I saw little beauty and wallowed in the belly of resistance. I sat back and watched my friends travel the world, start foundations, and live their unlived lives. One day I woke up and became angry with myself. I decided to fuel my dreams with the commitment they deserved. And subsequently, my passion began to consume resistance. Look into your own heart. I know there's a still, small voice poking you, telling you, as it is, as it has a million times, you have a calling that is yours and yours alone. You know it. No one has to tell you. You think resistance isn't real? Resistance can blind you from all beauty and proceed to bury you. As noted in Hitler's biography in historyplays.com, Hitler's goal was to be an artist. At 18, he took his inheritance and moved to Vienna to live and study. He applied to the Academy of Fine Arts and later to the School of Architecture. Ever seen one of Hitler's paintings? Neither have I. Resistance beat him. Call it overstatement, but I'll say it anyway. It was easier for Hitler to start the Second World War than it was for him to face a blank square of canvas. But before you try to conquer your canvas, make sure you get the basics of building a strong personal brand right. If the essentials like time management, truth, and decency aren't a part of your foundation of your personal or organization's brand, a chat about high values such as excellence and innovation will be premature. When learning any discipline, whether it's religion, sport, or business, trying to engage level 301 without having mastered level 101 is ridiculous. There's an old Bible parable that speaks to this foolishness in the book of Matthew. It says, you are blind guides, restrain a gnat and swallow a camel. When you live your unlived life, you allow yourself to be a better person of inspiration. And this sets off the butterfly effect. When you flap your wings, rather than keep them dormant at your side, you know, the universe honors you and shifts accordingly. Enjoy the beauty resistance creates, and remember what the Austrian writer Franz Kafka said. Anyone who keeps the ability to see beauty never grows old. Thank you for another podcast. This episode really inspired by the idea of personification, a book that I wrote in 2010. I hope it touches you somewhere really deep. Up next, we have our Cyber Health feature by Rianette. We'll be back next week with another episode of Unbranded. Thank you so much.
Hello, this is Rhea Nett. I'm from Safety Net Cyber Safety, and again, it's such a privilege to share information with you to make you aware of how to be a better and safer digital citizen. It's all about being responsible. Listen, the cyber highway is so cool. It's fun. We love it. It gets us to connect with people we would never have in the past. However, on the cyber highway, there are drunk drivers and there are people without licenses. And many times, the young ones are the ones without the licenses. If you look at how our kids are just being given technology nowadays and free access and Wi-Fi and so forth. But I wonder sometimes if parents have actually taught them the lessons, taught them how to drive on the cyberspace. And of course, the drunk drivers, well, those are the ones out there who are looking for trouble, the ones who are in it for the wrong reasons. But today I want to share with you, if you are using Facebook, if you are using technology, and obviously you are, if you're listening to this show, you are one of the people who use technology to be on the forefront of what's going on. So I wanted to share with you, Facebook has recently introduced privacy basics information to make it easier for people to find tools for controlling their information on Facebook. Now, why does this matter? Because there are people out there, like I said, the drunk drivers, who might want to get your information for the wrong reasons, whether it is to do marketing, whether it is to find you physically, whether it is to stalk you. There are many reasons why people would want to get your personal data. So it's important for us to look after ourselves. It's important for us to be cyber savvy. So the privacy basics feature that Facebook introduced is actually improved functionality and topics based on your most frequently asked questions. And this is all about your privacy and security settings. It's built using your feedback. Everything is organized so that information about protecting your privacy is easy to find. And the privacy basics section on Facebook puts you in the driver's seat with 32 interactive guides. That's quite a nice number. And it's available in 44 languages. So people share their most valuable moments on Facebook, and this platform wants to make tips and tools clear and accessible whenever you need them. So Privacy Basics gives you tips for things like securing your account, understanding who can see posts, and knowing what your profile looks like to others. Have you ever considered that you might be sharing your cell phone number with strangers? Have you ever considered the fact that you might be sharing your physical address as well? These are things that you need to look out for. So this part of Facebook's overall effort, or it is part of their overall effort to make sure you have all the information you need to share what you want with only the people you want to see it. So perhaps you have an ex-boyfriend or an ex-girlfriend you need to let go of, and or they need to let go of you. So how do you block them? How do you unfriend someone? And so, by the way, if you've ever wondered, they can't see it. They can't see if you unfriend them. But should you want to follow them and so forth, you need to look at these steps. So Facebook made these improvements as part of Data Privacy Day, and it's held every year on January 28th. Did you know? I mean, think about 50 years ago. I think people would have laughed if we said that there would be a Data Privacy Day. So what else does it entail? There is, you can choose who see your post, and this is something we don't take seriously enough. You know, you can choose whether your friends, everyone, or specific people see a post. And maybe sometimes it's something that is has got a religious message, or it's something that is quite sensitive. I always wonder how someone could post certain things not thinking about the 13-year-olds on Facebook. Remember, your friend's kids are perhaps on Facebook, and now you're sharing something that's definitely not appropriate. It's actually adult content. Then there's increase your account security by turning on login approvals. So you'll get a unique security code each time you access your Facebook account from a new device. And this is good, especially if you lose your devices and so forth. And then I wanted to tell you about the privacy checkup part. So we all need a checkup. This time of the year, it's good to have your medical checkups. Now maybe do your privacy checkup as well. The privacy checkup helps you review who can see your posts and info from your profile, like your phone number and your email address. It also shows you your settings for apps you've logged into with Facebook. And how many times are we so lazy? You download a new app and you just log in via Facebook. So this is important to go to the privacy checkup. You click at the top of any page on Facebook, example your homepage, there should be a little lock sign, and then select privacy checkup. So note that privacy checkup isn't available to everyone right now. For example, you may not have access to privacy checkup on certain devices. You can still adjust all of the settings covered by the privacy checkup by going to your privacy settings. Now, something that I spoke about a while ago was about the app permissions we give. And I want to please ask you, go into your app permissions section and just check what you've given them access to. Some apps can even post on your behalf. Some apps can read all your posts. Some apps can even get access to your friends lists. Now think about marketing campaigns. Think about, you know, security reasons. And if you think about from a legal point of view, the Protection of Personal Information Act in South Africa, these things soon will be able to bite us. So this is just a heads up from me, Rianette. Please join us for the conversation on SafetyNet. Listen, we aim to save lives by creating awareness for responsible digital engagement. That's why SafetyNet is spelled with a V. So it's SaveNet, SafetyNet. Join us on Facebook. Please join us on Twitter. I'm at Rianette, RIANETTE. And have a conversation with us. Tell us what you want to hear. And thanks so much for your time. Be safe on the cyber highway.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.